Well, good evening, boys and girls, and welcome to Reading with Rick again. We're on to a Thursday night already, and we're ready for two more great stories tonight. Did you enjoy last night? We read a book from the I Survive series in our second book of the night, and that was about the sinking of the Titanic, and I enjoyed that so much. We're going to do another one of those books tonight. But let's tell you about the first book we have tonight. This is called Good Night Gorilla, written by Peggy Rathman. Last night, The Little Engine That Could was the star, and tonight, it's Good Night Gorilla. As I look through this, I think I'm going to be describing the pictures a lot more than doing much reading because there aren't a whole lot of words. So you're really going to have to use your imagination tonight, and I'll do my best to describe the picture. So that's fun. That's the fun of reading, though, is using your imagination to figure out what the story is all about. And then in our second book tonight, we're going to do I Survived the Children's Blizzard of 1888. So if we thought that the Titanic sinking in 1912 was a long time ago, this was even longer ago than that. This is way, way back there in 1888. That's just a little bit after the Civil War was. Civil War was back in 1876. And this is only about 10 or 12 years later, so that's how far back we go tonight with the I Survived the Children's Blizzard of 1888. It says, the storm came out of nowhere. 11-year-old John Hale has already survived one brutal Dakota winter, and now he's about to experience one of the deadliest blizzards in American history. The storm of 1888 was a monster, a frozen hurricane that slammed into America's Midwest without warning. Within hours, hundreds would be dead, thousands terrified, lost, and freezing. John's inner strength is seriously tested when he finds himself trapped in the blinding snow, the wind like a giant crushing hammer pounding him over and over again. Will John ever find his way home? It says, when disaster strikes, heroes are made. So that'll be our second story tonight. I should tell you that if you hear my phone ringing tonight during any of the readings, it's probably because the Minnesota Vikings drafted me and I might have to go early. But no, I'm teasing. Okay, let's start. Good Night Gorilla by Peggy Rathman. And we see on the cover of this book, there is a little gorilla, and he is standing there, and it's dark out because it looks like Joe the zookeeper has his flashlight out, and he's looking down the path with his flashlight, but he doesn't see the gorilla. The gorilla, it looks like he swiped Joe's key to the cage, and he's got his finger up to his lips asking you to be quiet. So he doesn't want you to let Joe the zookeeper know that he's got the key. So on our first page, Joe the zookeeper is walking by the gorilla cage, and he says, good night, gorilla. And in the gorilla cage, you've got a tire swing, and there's a rope, and there's a little bicycle in there, and a little doll. It looks like a few bananas are laying in there. Oh, there's a whole big bunch of bananas hanging up there in that corner of his cage. But he, as Joe the zookeeper walked by, there's the gorilla. He reaches out and he just tugs at Joe's ring of keys that he's got tucked on his belt. As we look around the zoo, there's another cage there, and it looks like a big fancy bird is in that one. So Joe the zookeeper is making his rounds, make sure everybody is tucked in tonight. And the gorilla gets the key and he unlocks his door and he creeps down out of his cage. Joe the zookeeper, he keeps walking along while the gorilla, he knows he's free for now, and there's a little mouse right behind him carrying a big banana. And it's nighttime because the moon is up in the sky. Joel, the zookeeper, keeps walking and keeps checking all the cages, and Gorilla, he's just following along right behind him, but Joel, the zookeeper, doesn't hear him. Joel, the zookeeper, goes by the elephant cage, and he says, "Good night, elephant." And the elephant is watching. He's got his trunk up in the air. It's kind of resting on the cage. And there's the gorilla and the mouse walking right behind. And, oh, guess what's laying outside the elephant's cage? What do elephants like to eat? Peanuts. There's a whole bunch of peanuts laying on the floor. The next cage they come to is the lion cage. And the lion, he must have just finished supper. He's chewing on a big bone. And Joel, the zookeeper, walks by and says, "Good night, lion." And the gorilla, he let the elephant out of his cage, and now he's got another key. He's opening the lion's cage. So the gorilla is letting all the animals out. He's got the big elephant walking behind him. The mouse, now, he tied a string around the banana. It must have been too heavy for him to carry, so he's dragging that banana on the ground behind him, and the lion is going to be out of his cage. And Joe, the zookeeper, keeps walking by, and this must be a big zoo with all kinds of animals, because he says, "Good night, hyena. Good night, giraffe." And sure enough, the gorilla's got his keys out, and he opens up the hyena door, and then he opens up the giraffe door, and both of those animals, they step out of their cages. It's a long step for the giraffe, isn't it? He's got those long legs and that long neck. And the hyena, he is out of his cage too, and they're all following Joe the zookeeper. They come to another little cage. It doesn't have any bars on the cage, just a wall, because this next animal can't really get very high. Joe the zookeeper says, "Good night, armadillo." You know what an armadillo is? It's like it's about the size of a raccoon, except it's got a hard shell on its back, and when it gets scared, it curls up in a little ball, and that whole shell turns it into just a really tough, good defense for that animal. So Joe the zookeeper says, "Good night, armadillo." And there's the gorilla. Looks like he's ready to let the armadillo out of his little enclosure with the elephant and the lion and the hyena and the giraffe and, of course, the mouse all watching. And now, oh boy, the mouse is really having trouble with that banana. Now, remember I said he's pulling it on a string? Well, he can't even pull it now because that big giraffe, he's stepping right on the string, and that mouse is trying to yank it out from under the hoof of that giraffe. Good luck. Next page, they are headed out of the zoo because Joe the zookeeper is walking home. He lives right across the street from the zoo, and he's walking up his steps and up to his door. And right behind him are the mouse with the banana, the gorilla, the elephant, the lion, the hyena, the giraffe, and right at the end is the armadillo. And they're walking right out through the front door of the zoo. It's a big pink fence. And it says zoo in purple letters right over the top. Joe the zookeeper goes into his house, and wouldn't you know it, the animals, they went right with him. All those zoo animals are walking through Joe the zookeeper's house. Joe the zookeeper sits on his bed, and he's taken off his shoes after a long day. And there's Mrs. Zookeeper. She's already asleep in bed. All the animals curl up on the floor too, and that's a pretty big bedroom there that Mr. Joe the zookeeper's got. If he can fit a elephant and a giraffe and a lion and a hyena and an armadillo in there, and the mouse, oh, there's I was, and the gorilla sitting right on the edge of the bed, and he's yawning and covering his mouth. And where's the mouse? There's the mouse. He climbed up on the nightstand, and he's trying to pull that banana up by the string up onto the nightstand with him. And finally, Mrs. Zookeeper, she woke up when Joe the zookeeper was ready for bed, and she's turned on the light and says, "Good night, dear." And all the animals were asleep. The mouse pulled out a drawer, and he is using that for a bed. And The elephant has his trunk tucked around the tail of the lion, and the armadillo is curled up with the hyena, and, well, the gorilla climbed into bed. And the lights went out, and they all said, "Good night, good night, good night, good night, good night, good night, good night." So they're all saying good night to each other. Joe, I bet Joe the zookeeper's last name is Walton. All of a sudden, in the dark, one pair of eyes is seen. So everything is black except for two white eyes you see wide open. And all of a sudden, the light comes on, and Mrs. Zookeeper turned on the light because, uh-oh, who's that in bed with her? It's the gorilla. And she looks around, and all the animals are in their bedroom. But she's not scared. She just gets up in her nightgown, and she grabs Joe the zookeeper's flashlight. She grabs the gorilla by the hand, and they start walking out of the house and right across the street, right to the zoo again. And they're all lined up. There's the gorilla, followed by the elephant, and there's the lion, there's the hyena, the giraffe, there's the mouse lugging his banana, and coming down the steps in the rear is the armadillo. And Mrs. Zookeeper, she walks back out after she thinks she got all the animals back in their cages, and she says, "Good night, zoo," but she didn't get them all in because there's that little gorilla again. He's following her, and he's telling everybody to be quiet, don't tell her. And right behind the gorilla is Mr. Mouse with his banana again. She gets back into her house and is ready to get back into bed. And she puts the keys down by the end of the bed, and she says, "Good night, dear." And Joe the zookeeper says, "Good night." But climbing under the covers again is that little gorilla and Mr. Mouse. And finally she turns off the light, and Mr. Mouse says, "Good night, Gorilla." But Mr. Gorilla is already asleep. And I think he ate the banana because all that's left is the banana peel on the bed covers. Good night, Gorilla. And that's the end of the book. Good Night, Gorilla by Peggy Rathman. So he didn't want to stay in his cage at all, did he? And he didn't want his friends in the zoo to stay either, but he ended up sleeping at the house anyway, didn't he? So that's Good Night, Gorilla by Peggy Rathman. Okay, when we come back, as now I say good night to all you little gorillas, we're going to come back with I Survived the Children's Blizzard of 1888. So you have a good night. Don't sneak out of your cages. Stay in bed. And we'll see you tomorrow night. Okay, welcome back, everybody, to Reading with Rick, and we are ready for our second book of the night. This is, last night we did I Survived the Sinking of the Titanic in 1912, so tonight we do I Survived the Children's Blizzard of 1888, a really long time ago. I got this book from the Peers Library, so I want to thank Mrs. Welly for borrowing me these I Survive books. They're fun ones. They're good adventure stories. So here we go. Chapter 1, January 12th, 1888, Prairie Creek, Dakota Territory, around 10 a.m. A deadly blizzard raged across the prairie, and 11-year-old John Hale was trapped in a frozen nightmare. The wind screamed in his ears as he staggered through the blinding snow. His whole body was numb. The monster storm had come out of nowhere, a massive black cloud moving faster than a train. The temperature plunged, the wind howled, and then, roar, the sky exploded like a bomb, blasting snow and ice through the air. Ground-up ice raked John's eyes like tiny claws. The furious wind pounded him, tore at him, spun him around. He felt like he was locked in a cage with a furious beast, trying to rip him to pieces. And then a screaming gust picked John up and slammed him down. He tried to rise to his feet, but the wind was too strong. Snow was piling on top of him, burying him in an icy grave. John felt his flesh freezing on his bones. His body's warmth was seeping out of him like blood leaking from an open wound. John had never wanted to move west to this wide-open prairie. He was a city kid, not a tough pioneer. And now the maniac wind was hissing in his ears, taunting him. "You're weak. You'll never make it. You're doomed." That terrifying, evil wind was the last sound John heard as he was buried alive. Remember, way back then, they didn't have weathermen and weather channels and forecasters, so they just had to wait till the weather happened to actually know. Nobody could tell them that, oh, in 4 or 5 days it's going to be a blizzard, or next weekend we're going to have rain, or it's going to be really warm in the next couple of days. They didn't have any of that. So remember that. That's why they say it just happened in a hurry, because they had no way of knowing. Chapter 2. About 4 months earlier, September 19th, 1887, Prairie Creek, Dakota Territory, 7:45 a.m. They call it Dakota Territory because back in 1887, North Dakota and South Dakota weren't even states yet. Before they were states, they were just called territories. That's how long ago it was. So this is Dakota Territory, just to our west. John's little sister, Franny, had disappeared. She and John were on their way to their schoolhouse. They were halfway through the 3-mile walk from their farm. They were following an old wagon trail that cut through the tall golden grass. Franny, who was 5, had been skipping up ahead. John had been watching her blonde braids flap up and down like the wings of a happy yellow bird. Somehow, he had lost sight of her. John sped up, looking all around. It was hard to see through the grass, which rose up so high it tickled his neck. A unicorn could be prancing by, and John wouldn't even notice. "Franny," he shouted, "where are you?" "Whoosh," said the wind. "Swish," said the grass. But there was no sign of Franny. John sighed. She must be playing hide-and-seek, her favorite game. When Franny found a good spot, she'd sit there forever. She was going to make them late. It was hard enough for John, going to a school where he had no friends, but his teacher, Miss Rule, was mean. He pictured her now, her hair stretched back in a bun, her eyes glaring through her little round glasses. She was young and barely 5 feet tall, but she ruled over the schoolhouse like a Civil War general. John had never once seen her smile. When kids were late, Miss Rule made them stay in for recess and memorize some boring poem. Torture. "Franny!" John shouted. He stood on his tiptoes, peering into the distance. All he could see in any direction was wide-open prairie. It seemed to stretch out forever, an ocean made of grass. He still couldn't get used to it, all this empty land. John and Franny and their parents had moved here to Dakota about a year ago, from Chicago. It wasn't John's idea. He'd been happy living in the city. But Ma and Pa were fed up with their dark little apartment, their cursing neighbors, and the noise and stink that rose up from the street. For years, Ma and Pa had been talking about moving out west and buying a farm. But John always figured that that was just their crazy dream, like John wishing he could be a pitcher for the Chicago White Stockings, his favorite baseball team. Pa didn't make much money working at a cabinet shop. How could they ever afford to buy land for a farm? Then Ma and Pa heard they could get land in a place called Dakota. It was thousands of miles of open space west of Minnesota. Dakota wasn't a state, but it would be soon, folks said. And the government wanted farmers to come. They were even giving away big plots of land for free. All you had to do was build a farm and stay there for 5 years. Then the land was yours forever. For Ma and Pa, it was a dream come true. "We're headed west," Pa boomed. "We'll be pioneers," Ma said. John hoped the West would be like the places in his favorite adventure stories, with rivers filled with gold nuggets and brave sheriffs chasing after famous bank robbers like Billy the Kid. Ma and Pa sold practically everything they owned. They traveled west by train. It took 7 days to reach the edge of Dakota Territory. Then they bought a rickety wagon and an ox to pull it. John named the ox Shadow, after his favorite White Stockings pitcher, Shadow Pyle. It was a 2-day ride to the little town of Prairie Creek, if you could call it a town. Only about 20 families lived there on little farms scattered across the prairie. The main street was a dusty strip of dirt with a general store on one side and a hardware store and tiny hotel on the other. John's family settled on a 160-acre piece of land about 2 miles outside of town. There were no rivers of gold, no brave sheriffs. There wasn't even a bank for a guy like Billy the Kid to rob. There was only empty space and endless work. John and Pa were sometimes out in the fields from dawn until dark. Ma hardly ever stopped scrubbing and cooking and sweeping. Franny's scrawny little arms had sprouted muscles from hauling buckets of water from the well. And the weather, the roasting summer sun, the thunderstorms that blackened the skies. Winter days were so cold your spit froze before it hit the ground. Blizzards that came out of nowhere. Last winter the snow piled up almost to their rooftop. Pa had to dig a tunnel to get from the house to the barn. But for John, the worst part was the emptiness. He got a lonely feeling when he looked out over the prairie, an ache inside of him. It felt like a cold wind blowing right through his chest. John didn't belong here. He felt stranded in the middle of nowhere. And now Miss Rule was going to punish him for being late. Franny! But wait, what if Franny wasn't playing a game? She could have wandered too far into the grass and gotten lost. Last year, a little boy from town disappeared. One minute he'd been chasing jackrabbits behind his family's house. The next minute he'd vanished. John and Pa joined the big search, but the poor kid was never found. It was like the prairie had opened its grassy jaws and swallowed him whole. John cupped his hands around his mouth and yelled at the top of his lungs, "Franny!" The grass swished. The wind moaned. A flock of geese honked across the bright blue sky. But there was no sign of Franny. Chapter 3. John was at the edge of panic when a giggle rose from the grass just a few yards ahead. Franny's freckled face popped up. She grinned at him. "Boo!" "Franny, tricked you," she said. "You didn't trick me," John lied. "I knew exactly where you were hiding." "How did you know?" Franny asked with a frown. "I could smell you," John said, wrinkling his nose. "You stink worse than Princess." Princess was their cow. Franny had picked her name. Actually, Franny smelled a little like apples and Ma's soap, but John needed to get even with her for scaring him. Franny's smile fell away. Her eyes started to tear up. "I do not stink," she said. "All right," John said. He hated to see Franny sad. "But don't do that again. I thought I lost you, Fran. You scared me." Franny burst out laughing. "That's a funny joke, Johnny," she said. "I know you're never scared." And Johnny's heart lifted a little. It was good having a little sister who thought he was brave. They rushed the last mile to the schoolhouse, which was about a quarter mile past Main Street. It was just a small, unpainted building, more like an overgrown dollhouse than a school. The school was barely big enough to fit all 15 students. The big and little kids squeezed together in one room. Ms. Rule had to figure out how to teach all of them. Luckily, John and Franny weren't late. The schoolhouse door was still closed. Kids were milling around outside, waiting for the bell. Franny went to join a jump rope game. John looked around, wishing he had someone to talk to. Back in Chicago, he had more friends than he could count. Before school, he and his pals would shoot marbles or bug the girls they liked. But here, there were only three boys his age, Rex, Peter, and Sven. They'd been friendly to John last fall when he was brand new, but John always felt uneasy around them, afraid he would say something wrong and make a fool of himself. So he avoided them. Now, they mostly ignored John, or maybe it was John who ignored them. He wasn't sure, but what did it matter? He'd missed his chance. And anyway, they probably knew John didn't belong here. He had nothing in common with those tough pioneer boys. Peter and Sven were standing nearby, rubbing the sleep from their eyes, but then Rex came sprinting toward them, and Peter and Sven perked right up. Rex wasn't funny like Peter, and he didn't have big muscles like Sven. He was quiet and serious. But Rex was their leader, without a doubt. His family had been in Dakota longer than anyone. Rex skidded to a stop, huffing and puffing. "I found him," Rex exclaimed, wiping the sweat from his forehead. "Found who?" asked Peter. "King Rattler," Rex burst out, and the boys gasped. John's ears perked up. King Rattler was a huge rattlesnake that all the kids talked about. There were rattlesnakes everywhere in Dakota, stretching their golden brown bodies out on rocks, slithering through the tall grass, curling up in haylofts. Of all the sounds of the prairie, nothing chilled John's blood more than the rattling shake of its tail. "Get away, get away," it was saying. "Get away or I'll kill you." And King Rattler wasn't just any rattlesnake. He was the biggest and most vicious snake there was, a killer that had been terrorizing people for years. John had never seen him, but he'd heard the guys telling stories. Most snakes bit only if you stepped on them by accident. King Rattler would chase you down right to your door. He'd bite your horse and then leap up and sink his fangs into your neck. Or so the guy said. "I saw him at the creek," Rex went on, his voice rising. "I followed him. I found his den. I saw where he lives." "You found King Rattler's den?" Peter gasped. This was big news. Folks had been searching for years, John had heard. "There's a hole, a big nasty hole, right under a rock," Rex said. "I saw him go in. I saw it with my own eyes." John shuddered as he imagined the snake, the glistening fangs, the pink needle tongue, the deathly yellow eyes. "So now," Rex said, his eyes narrow and fierce, "we can kill King Rattler. We'll be famous," Peter hooted, and Sven grinned. Rex looked over, and he saw that John was listening in. John flicked his eyes down. Too late, though. He'd been caught spying. Now Peter and Sven were looking at him, too, and John started to get up and move away, but Rex took a step toward him. "Want to come?" he asked. John looked up in surprise. "Come where?" he stammered. "With us," Rex said, "to kill King Rattler." John blinked. They wanted him to help kill a monster rattlesnake? That was the dumbest idea John had ever heard. He opened his mouth to say, "No thanks." But the guys were looking at him hopefully, like they really did want him to come along. It had been so long since any kid had looked at him that way. Almost without thinking, John leaned forward. "Sure I would," he said. Chapter 4. 6 days later, Sunday, September 25th, 1887, around noon, at John's house. Their morning chores were done. John, Franny, Ma, and Pa were back from church. Now they were sitting at the table for Ma's special Sunday meal, squirrel stew. Sundays were the best. John didn't have to go to school, and usually the whole family took the day off from working. John would play cards with Franny or go out hunting with Pa. Some days he'd spend a whole hour just sitting around and doing nothing, like a millionaire. But today was the day he was meeting the guys at the creek to kill King Rattler. Of course, he hadn't told his parents the true plan for the afternoon. He'd said he was going fishing with his new friends. Good stew, Pa said as he sopped up the sauce with a hunk of fresh bread. It did smell delicious, but John's stomach was twisted so tight he couldn't take a bite. I'm glad you like it, Ma said, flashing a smile at Pa. I'll tell the cook. Ma, Franny giggled, you're the cook. Ma's big brown eyes widened in pretend surprise. I thought I was the queen. Of course you're the queen, Pa boomed, and this is your castle. Ma smiled because their house was the complete opposite of a castle. It was just one small room made of dirt. Pa had built it for them when they got here last fall. They wanted to live in a wooden house, but no trees grew in this part of Dakota. Pa couldn't just chop down a big oak and start sawing and hammering, and they couldn't afford to buy enough wood for a whole house. So, like most Dakota settlers, they built a house made of sod, dirt and grass peeled right up from the ground. Pa plowed up the sod in long strips, and then John helped him chop the strips into big blocks. They piled the blocks up to make the walls of their house. They had just enough money to buy some wood for the door and the roof. The house, a soddy, it was called, was one small room, barely big enough for their beds, the table and chairs, and the big black stove that cooked their food and kept them warm in the winter. When it rained hard, muddy water dripped down from the ceiling. The dirt floor turned into a mud puddle. Worms and spiders and mice popped out of the walls. But most of the time, the soddy was surprisingly cozy. The thick dirt walls helped keep the heat in during this winter. On oven-hot summer days, the soddy stayed cool. And when they were all sitting together like they were now, with one of Ma's delicious meals on the table, the little dirt house felt like home. Ma cleared away the stew bowls and brought out a berry pie. The sweet and buttery smell rose up, but John was too queasy to even have a taste. He kept imagining how it would feel to have King Rattler's fangs stab into his flesh. The bite wasn't the painful part, he'd heard. It was what the venom did to your body, how it poisoned your blood and rotted your flesh and then finally stopped your heart. And there was no cure for a rattlesnake bite. If you were lucky, the doctor could chop off the part of your body the snake bit. But most people died. Last year, a girl from his school was bitten while she was running barefoot in the grass. Lucky for her, the snake was just a baby. The little girl only lost a toe. John shuddered. What was he thinking? He wasn't tough like Rex and the guys. He was just a city kid. John, Ma said, putting down her spoon, are you feeling all right? You're looking a little green, son, Pa added. Oh, no, Johnny's turning into a frog, Franny said in horror. Ma had been reading Franny a fairy tale about a witch who turned a prince into a frog. That's just a saying, Fran, Ma said. When a person looks green, it means they feel sick to their stomach. Oh, no, Franny exclaimed. Johnny's going to throw up. I wonder if that's the Vikings. Nope, I guess not. I'm fine, John fibbed, sitting up straighter and digging his fork into his pie. If he wasn't careful, Ma was going to make him gulp down one of her disgusting medicines. The closest doctor was 20 miles from here, a two-day journey in their rickety wagon. So Ma had a shelf of home remedies, potions and oils and syrups she bought at the general store. Her favorite for upset stomachs was Brown's Bitters. It tasted like a skunk had died in the bottle. I feel all right, John said, forcing down a bite of his pie. Should be a good day for fishing, Pa said. Catch us a big one, Ma said, rubbing her hands together. I'll cook it for supper. John pictured a big, fat rattlesnake cooking in Ma's stew pot. Yum, Franny chirped. John stood up. If he didn't leave now, he'd puke for sure. John grabbed his cap and said goodbye. Chapter 5. Later that day, around 2 o'clock. The meeting place was a pond near the creek. John got there first, so he sat at the water's edge to wait. The air was cool, but the sun warmed his back. The water was like a mirror, and it matched the bright blue sky. As usual, the only sound was the moaning wind and the whooshing of the grass. John's eyes caught something sparkling in the dirt. He dug it out with his thumb. It was an arrowhead, a perfect flat triangle made of dark metal. John found arrowheads all the time around here. They belonged to Sioux Indian people who used to live on this land. Probably a Sioux hunter shot this arrow at a buffalo. Ms. Rule said that there used to be thousands of Sioux people here. They lived in villages and moved across the land with the seasons. In the fall, they hunted the buffalo that roamed all over the prairie in great herds. John had never met any Sioux people. That's because the American government had made them all leave here. The buffalo were gone too, every last one. The giant herds trampled crops and got in the way of building the railroad, so the soldiers and settlers shot them all. John held the arrowhead in his hand. He wondered who it had belonged to. Maybe it was a Sioux boy, a kid like him, hunting with his father like John hunted with Pa. Maybe that kid had a sister like Franny. He could have sat right there in this exact spot. Where was that boy now? John could have wondered about this all day, but just then he heard voices. It was the guys calling his name. Rex, Peter, and Sven rushed toward him, their snake-killing weapons clutched in their hands. Rex gripped an axe. Peter had a hoe. Sven had a big stick resting on each of his beefy shoulders. He handed one to John. Peter proudly held up a little canvas bag. 3 dead mice, he said. Snake bait. They set out for the creek, walking side by side, shoulders bumping. From the way the guys were grinning and bouncing with excitement, you'd have thought they were headed to a picnic. John's worries and heavy thoughts soon fell away. The guys chattered nonstop about everything from baseball to girls to whether Miss Rule would ever get married. No way, Peter insisted. She's 25, way too old. And too mean, Sven said. What about the cowboy? Rex asked. They'd all heard the rumor that Miss Rule was engaged to a cowboy. I don't believe it, Peter said, shaking his head. None of them liked Miss Rule, but Peter had a grudge because he got in trouble the most. He couldn't make it through the day without burping out loud or turning his eyelids inside out to make the girls scream. I heard that cowboy is in Montana, Sven said, building them a house. He's probably hiding out there, Peter said. She's scarier than a grizzly bear. I didn't know grizzly bears wore glasses, Sven laughed. Peter curled his fingers into circles to make pretend glasses. Learn this poem or I will eat you, he growled. They all cracked up, including John. He was glad he wasn't the only one who hated those boring poems. They kept up their chattering and joking till they got to the creek. The water was deep and running fast from a big rainstorm the night before. And suddenly, Rex stopped short. That's it, he said quietly, King Rattler's den. And he pointed to a big rock with a hole underneath. They all went quiet. Look, Sven whispered. There was a long, wide groove in the dirt like a track left by a fat wagon wheel, except no one could ever drive a wagon over here. It was a snake track left by a huge snake, and it looked fresh. Chapter 6. Set the bait, Rex said to Peter, and Peter walked up quickly and dropped the dead mice in front of the hole. Then he dashed back. Peter might be a clown, but he was a brave clown. Okay, Rex said in a steely voice, now we wait. You know what to do. All week at recess, they'd worked out their plan, huddling together like spies while the girls jumped rope and the younger kids played Red Rover. They'd figured they'd wait for King Rattler to poke his head out of his hole. Then they'd rush forward for the attack. Rex would chop the snake's head off with his axe. Peter would hack away with his hoe, and Sven and John would stand by to smack it with their sticks. When it was over, Rex would get to cut off the rattle. That was only fair, since he'd found King Rattler's den, and this whole mission was his idea. They chose a spot a few feet from the hole. They sat in the dirt with their backs to the creek. John tried not to think about the sound an axe would make when it chopped through the neck of a huge snake. He wondered what it would do when its head was hacked off. Was it like a chicken whose body kept moving even without a head? Would its jaws keep snapping open and shut, fangs shooting out venom? He hoped the guys didn't notice. They were quiet for a while, but Peter couldn't keep his jaw shut for long. Rex kept shushing him, but it was no use. Soon enough, they were all jabbering again. They bickered about which candy at the general store was the best and decided it was a tie between licorice and peppermint sticks. They talked about girls at school. The guys all liked Annie, who had curly hair and very white teeth. John liked Myra, who had a loud laugh and was helping Franny learn to jump rope, but he kept that information to himself. The wind turned colder. None of them were wearing coats, and soon they were rubbing their arms to keep warm. "My pa says it's going to be a bad winter," Rex told them. "He says blizzards are going to start early." "How does he know?" John asked, hoping it wasn't such a dumb question. "Birds have already gone south," Rex said, squinting up at the sky. "Animals know things we don't." Sven and Peter nodded in agreement. John wondered how any winter could be more miserable than last year's. He shivered just thinking about the bone-chilling cold. The first blizzard had struck in October. John and Pa were heading home from town when the sky turned dark. The snow started swirling so thick they couldn't see an inch in front of their faces. Luckily, their ox, Shadow, stayed on the path and got them home before they were frozen solid. "At least in winter there are no grasshoppers," Peter said, and Sven groaned. "Nothing worse than grasshoppers," added Rex. John smiled a little because he was sure they were joking. Nobody could be afraid of a little grasshopper. They didn't even sting. "You never heard about the grasshopper attacks?" Rex asked. John studied Rex's face and realized he wasn't joking. And then, leaning in close, the guys told John the story. Chapter 7. "It happened 3 years ago. In August," Rex began, "a cloud appeared in the sky from the west. It looked like a thunderstorm was coming," Sven said. "But the cloud looked weird, all shiny," Peter added. "It got closer and closer," Rex said. "There was this strange sound," and Peter started to click his tongue really fast. "That whole cloud was made of grasshoppers," Sven said. "There were millions." "Billions," Rex corrected. "The cloud was 10 miles wide." "And then they all dropped out of the sky," Sven said. And suddenly the guys all started talking at once, their voices getting louder and louder, their words all swarming together. "The grasshoppers were an inch long. They have huge eyes that bug out. They were everywhere. They'd cover your whole body. They'd crawl up your pants and down your shirt and into your ears and up your nose." John squirmed as he listened. He felt as if hundreds of tiny feet were skittering across his flesh. "The ground was totally covered with grasshoppers," Peter said. "They'd crunch when you stepped on them," said Rex. "My boots were covered with grasshopper guts." John felt queasy. "And then they ate all the wheat," Rex said. "All the wheat?" John asked. The guys nodded. "That's why they came, for the wheat," Rex said. "In just a couple of days, they attacked every farm in Prairie Creek. We lost almost all of ours, 20 acres. "Us too," Sven said. "We lost every stalk of wheat," Peter added. "People tried everything to get rid of them. They set fire, shot guns, dumped water onto the wheat stalks. The grasshoppers stuck to the wheat like glue." "The attack lasted a week until practically every stalk of wheat was chewed down to rubble. The grasshoppers devoured vegetable gardens, too." "We put blankets over the garden," Rex said, "but the grasshoppers ate the blankets." John listened in shock. "Then what happened?" he asked. "They laid their eggs and died." "We got lucky. We had a cold September, and the freezing cold killed the eggs. Otherwise, they would have hatched and come back the next year." "That's what had happened in Minnesota. The grasshoppers attacked 4 years in a row," Rex went on. "Why haven't they come back here?" John asked. The guys all shook their heads and shrugged. Then Peter leaned forward. "I got it," he said. "Maybe Miss Rule scared them away, and they busted out in honks and snorts. But then they all went quiet again." "What did people do without their wheat?" John asked. "Growing and selling wheat was the only way to make money here, unless your pa owned a store or worked for the railroad. John couldn't imagine what Ma and Pa would have done if grasshoppers had eaten their wheat crop. They'd have no money to buy coal to keep warm, for clothes, for supplies." "It was bad," Peter said. "Lots of families left Dakota after that." "People that stayed helped each other," Rex said, "so we all made it through." But suddenly Peter's mouth dropped open. His eyes practically popped out of his head. A chilling sound filled the air. And it was a... And that's when John saw it. The most massive rattlesnake he'd ever seen or imagined. There could be no doubt. It was King Rattler. He wasn't in his hole. He was just ahead on the bank of the creek, and he was coming right after them. Chapter 8. John and the guys all scrambled to their feet. John's heart pounded through his chest. But none of the guys ran. Somehow John kept his boots glued to the ground. He stared in horror as the giant snake coiled its body. It was like a thick rope tying itself into a knot. John could see its muscles rippling under its scaly skin, its head lifted higher and higher as its body coiled more tightly. Soon it was almost as high as their chests. Its forked tongue was flickering in and out like a candle flame in the wind. It seemed like a beast from one of Franny's fairy stories, a fire-breathing dragon, a monster from a dark, dripping cave. It was thicker than John's leg. From its nose to its tail, it had to be taller than Pa, 6 feet at least. Its skin was dull gold and covered with black and white triangles. Its rattle was huge, with at least 20 bands, one for every year it had been alive. John had heard this was an old snake. And they heard the rattle again. "Don't move," Rex whispered. It was getting ready to strike. John knew. That's what a rattler does. It coils itself so it can spring forward when it attacks. A rattler that big could leap forward at least 6 feet, maybe more. These thoughts raced around and around in John's mind like water spinning in a whirlpool. There was no way they could kill this snake. Maybe they could have if they had caught it when its head was just peeping out of its hole, but not like this. They'd need a cannon or an army of soldiers firing rifles. Their stupid snake-killing weapons were useless now. This snake had more than enough venom to kill them all. But the guys weren't ready to surrender. Rex was standing there, his axe gripped tight in his hand. Peter held his hoe ready to strike. Sven had his stick high in the air. John felt frozen. King Rattler was looking directly at him. Its deathly yellow eyes glowed, its mouth opened wide. Needle-like white fangs glistened inside its sickly pink mouth. Hiss! John's entire body started to shake. He took a step back, not realizing he was right at the edge of the creek. His foot slipped, and suddenly he was slipping down the bank. He tumbled backward, landing in the water with a freezing splash. He barely had a chance to take a breath as the churning water grabbed hold of him and sent him rushing downstream. John couldn't swim. Nobody he knew could swim. The water twisted and turned him, scraping him against the rocks as he was carried along. Water gushed into his mouth and up his nose. He tried to grab hold of rocks and sticks, anything to slow himself down, but it was no use. John wasn't going to be killed by a rattlesnake. He was going to drown. Chapter 9. Finally, the water pushed John close enough to the creek bank that he could grab hold of a thorny bush. The prickers tore up his fingers, but John held on tight and managed to pull himself out of the churning water. John clawed his way up the bank and sat there in the mud. He was coughing and wheezing as he tried to catch his breath. Where were the guys? What had happened to them? They must think he'd run off like a scared little rabbit. The guys would never let him forget this. He heard footsteps and voices calling his name, and the guys came bursting out of the bushes, rushing toward him, surrounding him. John braced himself. "Are you all right? We lost you. We thought you were a goner." They weren't mad at John. They were worried about him. John forgot his thorn-bitten fingers and his freezing, mud-soaked clothes. He scrambled to his feet and rushed toward them. "Did you kill King Rattler?" he asked. The boys eyed each other, and Rex slumped a little. "No, he went into his hole." And then Peter blurted out, "I was so scared I wet my pants." John looked down, and sure enough, there was a big wet stain on Peter's trousers. Rex frowned at Peter, just like Miss Rule did when Peter let out a big belch in the middle of a grammar lesson. But then Rex cracked a smile, and all at once they exploded into laughter, including John. He laughed at Peter's soaked pants, but also in amazement about what they'd done. They'd faced down King Rattler, the fiercest snake in Dakota. When they finally calmed down and wiped away their laughing tears, Rex got serious again. "It was a bad plan," he admitted. "I should have known he wouldn't be in his hole during the day." "No worries," Sven said, putting a comforting hand on Rex's shoulder. Now we know where he lives. We can come back and get him next Sunday. Nah, Rex said, it's getting too cold. He's going to be hibernating soon. We'll have to wait until spring. John tried not to show how relieved he felt. Peter shouted out, we'll be back for you, King Rattler. And he waved his empty mouse sack like a flag. Sven and Rex pumped their fists and stabbed at the sky with their weapons. They bellowed and hooted. John cheered along with them. He felt like he was at a White Stockings game. They ran together to the pond and stopped for a few minutes to catch their breath. Then it was finally time to say goodbye and go their separate ways back to their farms. John walked through the grass toward home. He was shivering in his wet clothes, but he barely noticed. He kept chuckling to himself as he thought of Peter. John was about a mile from home when he spotted the dark cloud rushing in from the northwest. During his time in Dakota, John had learned to recognize the different kinds of clouds that appeared in the sky. This one was steel gray and rimmed with white. John's heart pounded. It was a blizzard cloud. But how could there be a blizzard coming? It wasn't even October yet. John remembered Rex's father's prediction of a bad winter and the fact that the birds had left early. And now John wished he was a bird so he could fly home. The wind whipped the grasses back and forth. An icy chill filled the air. John shivered in his wet clothes. He broke into a run, pushing aside the blades of grass. He had to get back to his farm before the snow started to pour down. One of the first things he'd learned in Dakota was to never be outside in a blizzard. Last year, a farmer in Prairie Creek died in a blizzard. He'd been in his barn when it hit, and he tried to get back to his house. It was just 20 feet away. But the snow was so thick in the air, he couldn't find his way. He wandered around in circles until he finally couldn't take another step. His body wasn't found until the spring when the snow melted. John ran faster and faster, peering over his shoulder at the looming cloud. Would he make it home in time? Chapter 10. John was just steps from the soddy when the sky broke open and snow started to pour from the sky. Ma and Pa were standing at the front door, waving him in. I was about to come looking for you, Pa said, as he pulled John inside and slammed the door. Ma grabbed a quilt and wrapped it around him. I saw the cloud coming, John said, breathing hard and pulling the blanket tight. I ran the whole way back. Who ever heard of a blizzard in September? Ma fretted. John told them what Rex had said, that the birds had all flown south early. Pa frowned. Those birds could have warned us, he said. Daddy, birds don't talk, Franny said, barely looking up from her storybook. Franny was still too young to understand what a disaster it could be to have a snowstorm so early. When they'd lived in Chicago, there were stores where you could buy food no matter what the weather. But here, almost everything they ate came from the land. Ma grew their vegetables. They got their milk from Princess the Cow and their eggs from their chickens. The creek was loaded with fish. If Ma wanted rabbit or squirrel or goose for her stew, she'd send John or Pa out to shoot one. But nothing grew when the prairie was covered with ice and snow. The animals disappeared underground. The chickens wouldn't lay eggs, and Princess's milk would dry up. It wasn't until late April that the prairie started to sprout back to life. And so if they wanted to eat during the frozen months, they had to fill their cellar with food before the first big snows. Ma had been making pickles and jams all summer and lining up the jars in their little cellar. She had dozens of eggs tucked away in their salty beds, but they still had to harvest the potatoes and turnips which grew underground. If this blizzard kept up and the ground froze, those potatoes and turnips would rot. So would the pumpkins and squash still ripening on their vines. They wouldn't have enough to eat this winter. John stood nervously at the window with Ma and Pa watching as the snow turned the prairie white. Suddenly, Pa pointed into the distance. Look, he exclaimed, those clouds are breaking up. John and Ma followed Pa's finger into the distance. Sure enough, the sky was brightening. The snow slowed and then finally stopped. By supper, the snow had melted and the wet prairie grasses sparkled like glass in the setting sun. I guess winter changed its mind, Ma said. I think it was sending us a message, said Pa. We'd better get to work. They started before dawn the next morning. John got out of bed and put on his patched overalls, not his school trousers. He knew he and Franny would be staying home for weeks and wouldn't go back to school until the work was finished. Franny helped Ma dig up the potatoes and turnips. John and Pa plowed over the soil in the wheat field so it would be ready for planting in the spring. They patched up the soddy roof and filled in the cracks in the dirt walls. The hardest job was making haystacks. They had to be built just right, tall and tightly packed and rounded at the top, or the hay would rot. That hay would keep shadows and princesses' bellies full over the winter when there was no grass to munch on. They worked for weeks. It wasn't until the end of October that the cellar was packed full. The soddy was finally snug. The fields were plowed. They were ready for winter, as ready as they could ever be. Chapter 11. John clutched Franny's hand tight as they walked along the old wagon trail. It was a cold and dreary October morning when they were finally heading back to school. John's mind swirled with nervous thoughts. What if the guys had forgotten all about him? What if they ignored him like before? But just as the school came into view, John heard voices. There he is! He's back! Rex, Peter, and Sven came barreling over to him. They grabbed his arms and slapped his back so hard he almost fell to the dirt. But of course, John didn't mind. For the first time since he left Chicago, John actually looked forward to going to school. At lunchtime, he and the guys would squeeze together around one desk. They'd divvy up whatever food they'd brought from home. Sven's mother baked the best bread, the dark Swedish kind that tasted smoky and sweet. Peter's made the most delicious pies. John's favorite was made from the sour choke cherries that grew wild on the prairie. Rex got the same lunch every day, two potatoes roasted in their skins. He didn't complain, though. He said that on cold days he carried one hot potato in each pocket to keep his hands warm. John learned more about the guys and how their families had come to Dakota. Rex's family had come from Texas and traveled to Dakota before their town, Prairie Creek, even had a name. Rex didn't remember the month-long journey in a covered wagon, but he knew the whole family almost drowned when they were bringing their wagon across the Colorado River. Sven came from the farthest away, Sweden. The trip took almost 6 months by ship, train, and wagon. The worst part was the two-month voyage across the Atlantic in a leaky steamship crawling with mice. Sven spent most of the trip puking over the side. But it was Peter's story that hit John the hardest. His family came 5 years ago from Minnesota. Crossing into Dakota, they ran into a thunderstorm. The mules pulling their wagon got spooked and took off. The wagon nearly flipped over, and Peter's little brother William flew out. He landed on some rocks and died within the hour. "My ma didn't talk for 6 months after that," Peter said softly. John swallowed hard, and he noticed Rex and Sven did too. None of them said anything more, but they all inched a little closer to Peter. John didn't think he had any important stories to share. He'd never crossed a stormy ocean or a raging river. But one bright day at recess, the guy started asking John about Chicago. It turned out none of them had ever been to a big city, and they were dying to hear all about skyscrapers and restaurants and the electric lights that lit up the streets at night. "Lots of murderers live there, right?" Peter asked. "Maybe," John said. "I never met one, though." The guy seemed a little disappointed. "I heard there are rats as big as cats," Sven said. "There are," John said, and he told how once he woke up and found one sitting right on his bed. "What did you do?" Rex asked. John shrugged. "Just shoot it away." The guys fell over in laughing horror. You'd have thought John had fought off a dragon. "I hate rats," Rex said with a shudder. John found it amazing. This was a kid who'd stared down a monster snake, and a plain old rat gave him the willies? But John understood. To the guy, Chicago was a strange land, one filled with danger and mystery, like Dakota was to John. "What's the weather like there?" Sven asked. John shrugged. "It gets hot in the summer and cold in the winter," he said, "but nothing like here." And the guys nodded. Peter looked up at the sunny sky. "I'm thinking that maybe winter's not going to be so bad," he said. "It's been warm all week." "Remember, the birds left early," Sven said. "The birds could be wrong," Peter said. They all looked at Rex, who was polishing off his second potato. Rex just shook his head. "The birds are never wrong." Chapter 12. The first big blizzard hit the very next week, a howling storm that came in the night and lasted for 3 days. The weather cleared up until early November, and then it snowed off and on for most of the next 2 months. A Christmas Day ice storm left icicles hanging off the soddy roof and all the way to the ground. Franny licked one and got her tongue stuck. Ma had to melt some of the icicle with warm water so poor Franny's tongue wouldn't tear in half. But it turned out that winter was just getting started. On January 5th, John woke up shivering. The inside of the soddy wall shimmered with white frost. His teeth chattered so hard he was afraid they'd shatter. Pa checked the thermometer outside their front door. Minus 20, he announced with a brrr. Ma fed more coal into the stove, but it didn't do much good. When it got this cold outside, even the thick dirt walls of the soddy couldn't keep the warm air from seeping out. Of course, it was too cold for school. Nobody could go out in this weather. John wished he could stay in bed, wrapped tight in his quilt. But Shadow and Princess needed breakfast. He bundled up in his heavy woolen coat and scarf and mittens and stepped outside. The cold seemed to reach into his lungs and freeze his breath. His eyes watered and the tears froze to his cheeks. He rushed into the barn and warmed himself up by huddling next to Shadow. He tried to milk Princess, but only a few squirts came out, and the milk froze before it even hit the bucket. As he came out of the barn, he saw Pa standing in front of one of their haystacks. It looked like someone or something had chewed right through its center. "What happened?" John asked. "Some animal must have slept there last night," Pa said. John noticed little paw prints leading to and from the stack. "Looks like it was a fox," Pa said. "He hid in the haystack?" John asked. "Sure," he said. "The walls are good and thick. Keeps the cold out." John helped Pa fix the haystack. By the time he came in for breakfast, his face was completely numb. Icicles hung from his eyelashes. It took two mugs of Ma's tea to warm him up again. For a solid week, they couldn't leave the soddy except to feed the animals and to get water. They couldn't even use the outhouse. Ma put up a curtain in the corner and they used a bucket. As the days dragged by, John started to feel like a pickle trapped in a jar, a cold and very smelly jar. But on the morning of January 12th, Franny shook John awake. "It's summer," she announced. "Not quite," Pa laughed, "but it warmed up. It's almost 30 degrees. And after the bone-cracking cold of the last week, it did feel practically like summer. John had only one thought. They'd be able to go to school. John rushed through his chores and gobbled up his porridge, and he and Franny flew out the door. Ma called after them from the doorway. "Wait, your mittens and scarves." "Don't need 'em, Ma," John hollered back. "It's summer, Ma, remember?" Franny laughed. As she and John walked, Franny looked up at the sky. "Look," she said, "it's like a fairy tale." The sky did look different, pale blue and streaked with gold. John had never seen anything like it. Chapter 13, January 12, 1888, The Prairie Creek School, around 10 a.m. After 7 days of being cooped up because of the cold, the kids at school acted like bank robbers who'd escaped from jail. Nobody wanted to sit still. And to their surprise, Miss Rule cut their grammar lesson short. "I wouldn't mind a little fresh air," she said, and the schoolhouse erupted in cheers. John and the guys leapt out of their seats. Kids poured outside, most without their coats and wraps. Franny ran off to play hide-and-seek with her friends. John and the guys stayed in front. The hard-packed snow was slick like an ice rink. They slid around, racing each other and spinning until they were too dizzy to stand. John was sliding across when someone came up right next to him. Myra. "Race you," she said, smiling as she whooshed by. Her flower dress billowed behind her like a sail. John's heart somersaulted inside his chest. He tried to catch up with her, but she ran off giggling with Annie. John wondered if the guys had seen that. He looked around and realized they weren't skating anymore. They were on the schoolhouse steps. John went over, and they looked uneasy. Rex was peering into the sky to the north of them. "What's wrong?" John asked. "See that?" Rex said, and John followed Rex's gaze. And that's when John saw it in the distance, a gray shadow in the sky. At first, he thought he was imagining it, that the blinding brightness of the day was making his eyes play tricks. But no, Rex was right. There was something in the sky, something big and dark, and it was getting bigger by the second. It was coming this way, and it was moving very fast. Rex's mouth fell open. "What the..." They all stood and watched as the shadow in the distance took shape. With each second, it got bigger and darker. It was a cloud of some kind, dirty gray and billowing and stretching out across the land. The temperature was dropping fast. John was shivering, not just because of the cold. He didn't know what he was looking at. He just knew it was bad. The schoolyard went quiet. Kids stopped sliding in the snow. All eyes were on the churning cloud. "That's a huge storm," Rex said. "I've never seen anything like it." A low rumbling rose up. The ground shook. And now Miss Rule was clanging the bell. "Children, come inside now. Hurry!" The day seemed to turn to night. And then came an ear-splitting roar. It sounded like a train was speeding right by them. But of course, there was no train anywhere near here. It was the sound of a monster blizzard closing in. Kids rushed into the schoolhouse. John was swept up the stairs in the wave of panicked bodies. Suddenly, he was inside and the schoolhouse door banged shut. And then, roar! Chapter 14. The entire building shook. A window shattered, and snow and ice exploded into the schoolhouse. But John hardly noticed. He barely heard the screeching wind or the cries of little kids. He was looking all around. Where was Franny? It was dark inside the schoolhouse. Miss Rule struggled to light a lantern, but John could see well enough to know that Franny wasn't there. A crack of fear almost knocked him off his feet. She'd been playing hide-and-seek. She probably found some perfect hiding spot off in a corner of the schoolyard, and when everyone ran inside, she'd been left behind. How had John let that happen? How could he have forgotten his sister? John rushed to the door and flung it open. A vicious blast of wind and snow nearly knocked him down. He clung to the doorframe to keep his balance. "Franny!" he cried, and Miss Rule called to him. "John, no!" But John couldn't wait. Franny was out there. The storm's icy hooks seemed to snatch him from the doorway. The wind roared in his ears and yanked him down the stairs. It threw him onto the ground. Ice and snow lashed his face. He gasped for breath as the freezing air shocked his lungs. John grabbed the stair railing and struggled to his feet. He pushed himself forward, staggering, into the frozen darkness that had swallowed the schoolyard. "Franny!" he cried, and roar! The storm screamed back. He looked around, but it was impossible to see. The snow gushed down from the sky and churned in the wind. Ground up ice flew into John's eyes, coating his lashes and lids. With each blink, the ice scraped painfully against his eyeballs. But even worse was the furious wind, which slashed at him from every direction. John felt as if he was locked in a cage with a pack of wild beasts, all trying to tear him to bits. He thought of that farmer who died in last year's blizzard. It hadn't really made sense to John how a strong man could get lost and freeze to death just a few yards from his house. But now, as John staggered blindly along, spinning in the wind, he understood all too well. Crushed bits of snow sifted down his collar and blew up his sleeves and trouser legs. Soon, every inch of his skin was crusted with ice. The cold seeped through his flesh and muscles and stabbed into his bones. John was shivering so hard his bones felt as if they would crack apart. A gust of wind smashed against him. He fell back into the snow, and now he couldn't stand up. The wind pressed down on him like a giant boot, crushing him into the ground. Ice was filling his nose, making it harder and harder to breathe. A feeling of terror came over John. He'd never felt so tiny and so helpless. He'd made a terrible mistake, he realized. There was no way he would be able to find Franny in this blizzard. He was going to freeze to death. Chapter 15. John mustered the last of his strength and screamed out at the top of his lungs, "Franny!" And the blizzard screamed back. But then another voice punched through the blizzard's howl. "John!" It wasn't Franny. It was Miss Rule. Her voice was muffled by the wind, but he thought she was somewhere very close. And then a hand clamped onto his arm. Miss Rule had found him. She gripped his arm tighter and managed to pull him up. John was so freezing cold that his body wasn't working right. He couldn't feel his feet. He kept stumbling and falling to his knees. Luckily, Miss Rule was stronger than she looked. She wrapped her arm around John's waist, and she practically dragged him through the rising snowdrifts and up the steps to the schoolhouse door. The next thing John knew, he was inside. He collapsed onto the floor. He couldn't see through his frozen eyes, but he felt people surrounding him. Hands swept snow from his head. Gentle fingers brushed ice from his face. A blanket came around his shoulders. John would have died of embarrassment if he wasn't practically frozen to death. And then someone hugged him, and John smelled apples and soap. Could it be? Was he dreaming? Franny? Hot tears welled up in John's eyes, melting the ice that crusted his lashes and lids. He stared at his sister's face. He had never in his life felt so relieved. "Why did you go outside?" she cried. "I thought you were lost," Johnny stuttered through his chattering teeth. "I was looking for you. I snuck inside and was here hiding under Miss Rule's desk for the game." No wonder John hadn't seen her. "Help John up and let him get closer to the stove," Miss Rule said. Peter, Rex, and Sven all lifted John to his feet and practically carried him across the room. Myra brought over a chair so he could sit. The guys hovered around him. Franny glued herself to John's side. But Miss Rule shooed everyone away. "Let him get warm," she said. Myra took Franny by the hand and the guys moved away. Miss Rule was still covered with snow. She was untying a rope that was knotted around her waist. John realized she must have tied the other end to something in the schoolhouse. That's how she had made sure she'd be able to find her way back inside. How smart of Miss Rule, and brave. She must think he was a fool to run outside in the blizzard. She must hate him more than ever. John took a breath. "I'm sorry, ma'am," he said. His teacher looked at him with surprise. She wasn't wearing her glasses. Her bun had come loose. Brown curls hung around her face. She didn't look scary. "You thought your sister was out there," she said. "What you did was brave." Their eyes locked together for a moment. A gentle smile flickered across his teacher's face. She patted John's arm before she walked back to her desk. Maybe it was the fire in the stove, but suddenly John felt warmer. The wind screamed louder. The schoolhouse walls shuddered and the windows rattled, but Ms. Rule, her hair back in its bun, was steely and calm. She gave all the older kids jobs. When John was warmed up again, he helped the guys sweep away the snow that was drifting under the door and through the cracks in the walls. Myra and Annie kept watch over the little kids and soon had them playing Simon Says. Moving around helped them stay warm. John kept his eye on Franny, but now he couldn't stop thinking about Ma and Pa. What if Pa had been out in the field when the blizzard hit? What if Ma had been in the barn? It was very cold in the schoolhouse, even with Miss Rule feeding extra coal into the roaring fire in the stove. John kept looking at the coal bin. There was barely enough coal to last a few hours more. What would happen when all the coal was gone? They'd have to burn the books, and then the desks. And after that, John tried not to think about it. Chapter 16. Suddenly the schoolhouse door flew open with a loud bang. An icy blast of freezing air and snow exploded into the room. The wind had ripped off the door. But no, it wasn't the wind. Three men stumbled into the schoolhouse. One of them wrestled the door closed again. The men stood there, breathing hard. They were so caked with snow and ice, they looked like walking snowmen. Myra went running over. "Papa," she said, ignoring the snow that covered him and throwing her arms around him. The other men were Mr. Johnson and Mr. Lowry, who owned stores in town. "We've got three sleds outside," Myra's father said, his voice rising over the wind. "Plenty of room for everyone. Blankets, too. We're going to get you into town, to the hotel. We can wait out the blizzard there and then get everyone home when the storm's over." And cheers rang out. They'd been rescued. Peter held up his broom and hooted. Ms. Rule closed her eyes, looked up, and whispered something to herself. And then she clapped her hands and called the class to order. "Everyone get their coats and wraps and line up." "Let's be quick," said Myra's father. "Storm's getting worse. The horses are freezing." Ms. Rule divided the children into three groups. She would ride in the biggest sled in the front with the six youngest children. Myra and Annie would take charge of three younger girls and go with Mr. Johnson in the second sled. John and the guys would be in the third sled with Mr. Lowry. John didn't want to be away from Franny, but there was no way he could argue, and he knew Miss Rule would keep her safe. Myra's father flung open the door, and they faced the brutal cold. It was more freezing now than it had been when John was stuck outside. The snow poured down harder. It was like standing under a waterfall made of snow and ice. Within seconds, they were all covered. John held Franny's hand tight as they pushed through the wild, frozen swirl. There were lanterns on each sled. The lanterns cast a ghostly yellow light, just enough to show the outline of the sleds. Each was a simple wooden wagon mounted on metal sled rails and hitched to a single horse. John felt so sorry for those horses. Their fur wasn't much protection in this cold, this harsh. He wondered how long they'd be able to stand it. John lifted Franny into the first wagon and made sure she was wrapped in a blanket. It was useless to try to talk over the screaming, hissing wind. He hugged his sister tight and then hurried back to his sled. He climbed up and settled down next to Rex. Mr. Lowry was already in the driver's seat, holding the reins. John and the guys had one big blanket to share. They put it over their heads to try to keep the snow and ice out of their faces. But it was useless. The snow was ground up fine, so fine it completely filled the air. The glassy ice raked at his eyeballs like tiny claws. John sat there, miserable and shivering. But he reminded himself that they were close to town. The trip shouldn't take more than 10 minutes. The guys weren't complaining, were they? John had to be tough. Finally, the first sled started to move, and its yellow glowing lantern light disappeared. The second sled followed. Mr. Lowry was about to snap the reins to get their horse moving, but just then the wind let out a vicious howl. There was a crunch, and a hunk of the schoolhouse roof came flying through the air. It smacked the horse on the back. The horse reared in terror. The sled rocked and almost tipped over. Mr. Lowry tumbled out onto the ground. The horse took off in panic, dragging the sled and John and the guys along with it. And now they were speeding through the blizzard out of control. Chapter 17. Rex crawled forward and tried to grab hold of the reins, but it was hopeless. The horse was running so fast the sled was practically off the ground. It rocked back and forth like a tiny boat on a storm-tossed ocean. Every time the sled hit a bump, the wood cracked and groaned. "We have to jump!" Rex screamed. He was right. Any moment the sled was going to break apart. They could be trampled under the horse's hooves or crushed by the sled. "Go!" Rex cried. Heart hammering, John struggled to his feet. He closed his eyes, held his breath, and threw himself off the side. He landed hard and rolled away as the metal sled rail sliced by him just inches from his head. John lay there panting. Finally, he sat up. To his relief, Sven was right next to him, and Rex and Peter were behind. They all crawled closer to each other and sat in a huddle. Nobody had gotten hurt from the jump off the sled, but they were all shivering hard. John's hands and feet were completely numb. They couldn't last out here for much longer. Rex was looking all around. "We're near the Ricker farm," he shouted. The Rickers had a real wooden house with 3 rooms. "I'm pretty sure the house is right over there," Rex shouted. "Where?" Sven shouted back. Rex looked around. "Close!" John's heart sunk. Close? That word meant nothing in a blizzard like this. The schoolhouse had been just a few feet away while John was staggering around the schoolyard. If Miss Rule hadn't come to his rescue, he'd be a frozen corpse by now, buried in the snow. It would be almost impossible to find the Ricker house. It might as well be on the moon. But they had 2 choices, get moving or freeze to death right here. So when Rex shouted, "Come on," they all struggled to their feet and followed. They staggered through the wall of slashing snow and ice. The wind's nonstop scream burrowed through John's skull, deep into his brain. It was taunting John, hissing at him as he tried to push his way forward. "You're weak. You can't make it. You're doomed." The wind was right. John didn't belong out here in Dakota. He'd always known it, and now he'd never escape. John walked with his head down, crouched over like an old man, pushing himself through the wall of wind and ice and snow. He could make it only a few steps without falling. One of his friends would grab his arms and yank him back up, but then Rex would fall down, or Peter, or Sven, and it would be John helping lift them up. on and on they went, battered by the maniac wind, lashed by the ground glass ice, falling down, standing up, falling down, standing up, colder and colder and colder. And then came a savage gust, an ice-packed whirl so furious it knocked them all down at once. And this time not one of them could stand back up, not even Rex. They sat there, sinking deeper into the snow. John felt the last of his body's warmth seeping out of him like blood leaking from a deep cut. That screaming wind was right, John thought. They were doomed. Chapter 18. Precious minutes ticked by, and none of them moved. It was getting colder. But down here, close to the ground, the wind wasn't quite as strong. The air wasn't as thick with swirling snow. John managed to wipe the frozen snow from his eyes, which is why he saw it, the outline of something very big, just a few yards ahead. "There's the house!" John shouted. And they all lunged forward, crawling desperately through the snowdrifts. John's heart pounded with excitement. They'd made it. They'd be safe. The boys pushed themselves along, fighting their way forward. It wasn't until they were just inches away that they saw it wasn't the Ricker house. It was a big haystack. Peter let out a big sob. Rex cursed and looked away. "The house must be this way," he shouted. Rex stepped forward, but John grabbed the back of his jacket and pulled him back. "No," John shouted. John might not be a real pioneer like Rex. This was only his second Dakota winter, but he knew this for sure. They'd never find the Ricker house, not in time. They had to get out of this wind and snow. They had to try to get warm inside the haystack. John remembered the fox that had hidden in their haystack overnight. Didn't Rex say that animals were always right? John turned to Rex. "We won't make it," he shouted over the wind. "We have to take cover in here." And now John took the lead. He punched a hole through the thick crust of snow and ice that covered the haystack. He reached through and grabbed fistfuls of the soft hay to make space. Rex and Peter and Sven were helping him. They worked desperately, jabbing their hands in, pulling out hay. They all worked together until they had a little cave big enough for them all to fit. And then they crawled in, lying flat and squeezed together. It was still freezing cold. John's numb hands and feet felt like blocks of wood. He couldn't stop shivering. But finally, the cruel wind couldn't reach them. The ice and snow couldn't tear at their faces. And soon, the heat from their bodies started to warm up the small space. "Don't sleep," Rex said. John had heard what happened to people who fell asleep in the freezing cold. They never woke up. That's why freezing to death wasn't the worst way to die, he'd heard, because you fell asleep before your heart stops. And so now they fought hard against sleep, just like they'd fought against the wind and snow. They took turns telling stories. They counted 1,000 and then did it again backward. They said prayers. John told them the name of every player on the Chicago White Stockings. The hours passed. The blizzard raged on. They ran out of stories and got tired of counting. And then Peter started muttering in a strange rhyming way, and John realized he was reciting one of the long, boring poems Miss Rule had made them memorize. They all joined him, and then they recited another, and another. They all knew so many. It turned out that not all of those poems were so boring. Some were about pirates and sailors, one was about the summer, and the words made John feel warmer. There were poems that made no sense, like one about a pig wearing a wig, but it actually made them laugh. Those poems kept them up for hours more. But finally, their voices became ragged. Their words faded away. John's mind started to drift. "Don't sleep, don't sleep." His eyes fluttered. "Don't sleep, don't sleep." And John's eyes shut. "Don't sleep, don't." John's eyes stayed closed. Everything got quiet. Even the sound of that screaming wind. Was this ferocious storm finally dying? Or was John? Chapter 19. About 2 weeks later, newspapers from New York to Seattle printed stories about the deadly blizzard that had struck America's northern prairie. It was one of the most powerful snowstorms ever to hit America, more like a frozen hurricane than a blizzard. Winds had reached 70 miles an hour. Temperatures had dipped down to minus 40. Cities like St. Paul, Minnesota, and Lincoln, Nebraska were shut down. Towns were buried. Hundreds were dead. It was a blizzard so terrible that soon it had a name, the Children's Blizzard, because at least 100 of the people who died were school children. The newspapers were filled with sad and terrible stories about children who became trapped in the frozen, swirling winds. But there were miracles, too, like how one teacher tied her 10 students together with a rope and led them to a farmhouse a half mile away from their school. Or the kids who made it through the night in a shelter they built from snow. Or the brothers who huddled in a barn with two pigs that kept them warm. And the four boys from the tiny town of Prairie Creek, Dakota, who survived the blizzard in a haystack. John didn't read any of those stories, not at first. For the first week after the blizzard, he wasn't sure if he was alive or dead. The storm had ended just a few minutes after he and the guys had fallen asleep. They'd been in that haystack almost all night. John was barely breathing when Mr. and Mrs. Ricker carried him and the other boys from the haystack into their farmhouse. When Ma and Pa got there later that day, he heard them calling his name. He felt their hands on him, but he couldn't open his eyes. He couldn't move or speak. He felt locked away, caught in a frozen nightmare. Most of the time, he thought he was still in the haystack or curled into a snowdrift. That hissing blizzard scream still echoed in his ears. It wasn't until a week after the blizzard that John finally opened his eyes. It was the middle of the night, and it took him a long, panicked moment to understand that he wasn't in the haystack or in a frozen grave. He was in the warm soddy, tucked into his bed. Franny was curled up next to him. Pa was dozing in a chair, pulled close. Ma was sitting on John's bed. "Ma," John said in a crackling voice. The fire in the stove cast a golden glow, and John saw the tears in Ma's eyes as she smiled down on him. And at that moment, that was when, for John, the terrifying blizzard at last came to an end. Chapter 20, about 3 months later, Sunday, April 29th, 1888, Prairie Creek, Dakota Territory, during the afternoon. The snow had melted, and the prairie was slowly sprouting back to life. Bright green shoots pushed up through the brown grass. Enormous flocks of geese and ducks flapped across the blue sky. The winter was over. The birds were back. John and the guys had returned to school at the end of March, and now, on this bright and warm day in April, here they were at the creek. They'd come for King Rattler. John had brought Pa's rifle this time. Rex clutched his axe, and Sven was ready with his stick. Peter had found a dead rabbit half-eaten by a fox. That was the bait. King Rattler could attack from any direction, Rex reminded them, his voice strong but still raspy from months of coughing. He'd caught a bad case of pneumonia after the blizzard and looked too skinny and frail. They were all still healing. Sven lost two toes from frostbite and was walking with a cane. Peter had lost a pinky. "I never liked that finger anyway," he swore. John's feet had been so badly frostbitten that he'd nearly lost them. His hands, too. His feet had swelled up like balloons. The skin on his hands and feet turned black, like meat left too long on the fire. The pain was so terrible that he couldn't move. For days he was in bed, soaked in sweat and trying not to cry. But Ma kept telling him that the pain was good news, that it meant blood was starting to flow again, that his hands and feet were coming back to life. She kept dosing John with Brown's bitters and gently rubbing his skin with some cream that smelled like rotten apples. Slowly the black skin peeled away, and underneath was brand new skin, soft and pink. "Your feet look like piglets," Franny had shrieked happily. John stared at his bright pink feet and realized Franny was right. He started to laugh, and Ma and Pa did too, and after that some of the gloom cleared from the soddy. It helped that people from town kept coming to visit them. They brought food, precious jars of berry jam, and baskets of eggs from their cellars. Myra visited and gave John a scarf she'd knitted herself. Mr. Lowry came and told them what happened to him after the horse bolted with the sled. He'd made it back into the schoolhouse and had burned the desks to stay warm through the night. Ms. Rule stopped by a few times. Of course, John had to tell her about those long poems she'd made them memorize, how they helped John and the guys stay awake in the haystack. Ms. Rule flashed a smile big and bright. But then John had heard or by then, John had heard the big news. Ms. Rule was getting married. She'd be leaving Dakota this summer and moving to Montana. John would miss her. He knew the guys would too, even Peter. "I hear she's invited the whole town to the wedding," Rex said now. "It's going to be at the schoolhouse." "What should we get her for a present?" Sven asked. They were stumped. "I know," Rex said, his eyes lighting up. "King Rattler's rattle." They all grinned. Rex was a genius. Who wouldn't want a huge snake rattle as a wedding gift? They argued about what food would be best for the wedding, choke cherry pie or molasses cake. They swore they wouldn't wear their itchy church clothes, but thought they might have to. They hoped Miss Rule's man would wear his cowboy hat. And then there was a rustling sound in the bushes. "Shh," Rex said, and they all jumped up. John gripped Pa's gun. Rex raised his axe. Sven held up his cane. Peter looked ready to pounce. It was time to finally kill King Rattler. Chapter 21. The boys all waited. John's heart pounded, and then it appeared from the bushes. An enormous frog. It looked at them with its bulging eyes. Croak. They all cracked up and watched the frog hop away. And now it was getting late, and time to head home. "We'll be back for you, King Rattler," Peter shouted. They headed back to the pond, shoulders bumping, smiling and joking as they limped along. They said their goodbyes, and John made his way back toward his farm. He breathed in the smell of new grass and fresh dirt. Soon he and Pa would be planting their wheat field. If their crop was a good one, they'd have enough money to start building a real house made of wood with two rooms, practically a castle compared to the soddy. There would be more work than ever as they readied their field. John thought nervously about what the spring and summer could bring. Thunderstorm, hail, prairie fires, funnel clouds, grasshoppers. Dakota was a harsh land. But they were staying here, at least for now. Ma and Pa had talked about leaving in those terrible weeks after the blizzard. John had heard them whispering softly at night when they thought he was asleep. That storm had terrified his parents. They'd been so desperate to find John and Franny that Pa had gone out into the storm. He'd realized his mistake right away. Within 5 steps, Pa was completely lost in the white swirl. He stumbled blindly, and then he heard a bell clanging over the roaring wind. It was Ma standing in the doorway, leading him home. Leave or stay, leave or stay. Ma and Pa weren't sure what to do. They'd poured every cent and their hearts into this farm. And what would they do back in Chicago? Pa had left his job. How would they pay for an apartment? How would they buy food? They couldn't plant a wheat field in Chicago. Their neighbors in the city had never visited with pies and eggs and jars of jelly. This would be their one and only chance to own a farm. And so, finally, Ma and Pa decided to stay put. And John was glad, because how could he leave the guys? There would be more storms ahead, John knew, but somehow they'd all made it through the blizzard. Whatever was coming, they would face it. Maybe that's what it meant to be a pioneer. John was about halfway home when something caught his eye, maybe 20 feet to the side. It was a snake, a massive snake. John stopped breathing. Could it be? It was King Rattler. The giant snake was stretched out in the grass. His diamond skin gleamed. His tongue flickered in and out. Moving very slowly, John lifted Pa's rifle. He took aim at the giant snake. Imagine what the guys would say when he brought them the rattle. John put his finger on the trigger. He steadied himself. King Rattler didn't move, and lying there, he actually didn't look that fierce. He looked like a very old snake trying to soak up some last rays of sun. John wondered, how long had that big snake been on this land? A very long time, longer than any of them. Suddenly, it seemed wrong to John that this old snake would be gone. He lowered the gun and walked quickly away. They'd have to think of a different present for Miss Rule. John walked a mile more, his feet aching. Finally, he saw their soddy in the distance. He spotted Ma digging in her garden, getting it ready for spring planting. Franny was dancing around outside. Shadow and Princess grazed on tender green sprouts. Pa was on the roof of the barn, patching up the last of the winter holes. He saw John and waved. The afternoon sun had turned the brown grass bright gold. Whoosh, the warm breeze blew, pushing John along. Whoosh, it seemed to whisper gently into his ear, you're home. And that's the end. That was a long story, wasn't it? But it was a great story. I survived the children's blizzard. So next winter, when it starts to snow, just imagine remembering back to this book about that blizzard and how scary that was to be trapped out there. So that's it for tonight. Boy, it's almost dark. It is dark, isn't it? Boy, we read all the way to dark. So we better get out of here and let you go to bed. And tomorrow night, more stories on Reading with Rick. Okay, you have a great night, everybody.